Broadcasting through our flagship station, KNYE in Pahrump, Nevada, and worldwide on the internet, this is Midnight in the Desert. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be in this great, big, wonderful world. Thank you for making us your home for the best in anomalous talk radio. We've made it through another week, kids. Thank you for joining us. For those of you that missed out or didn't stay with us for the entire show last night, we went long. We stayed all 3 hours with our guest, who was originally slated for 2 hours, and then he hung in for a little bit extra. So there was about another 30 minutes of after show, and it's all available if you're a subscriber. So all you have to do is go to midnightinthedesert.com to subscribe and catch up on all of that information. A little bit later on in tonight's show, Paul Evans joins us. We're going to go into coma, the space between life and death. He has a fascinating story to share, and we will be examining that in a few minutes, the pass incident. We'll be talking about that, but a couple of quick mentions with the news. This is a very weird story, and I've sent it over to Keith so we can put it up on Midnight in the Desert. A doorbell camera captured what appears to be a ghost playing a form of Ding Dong Ditch. Now, like many of you, I'm very skeptical when it comes to some of this footage, and I'm one of the first to say it looks like a bug or a distortion of moisture. But in this case, if this doesn't look like a ghost or a predator-like shimmer, I don't know what does. A vigilant homeowner fears that she may have been the victim of a haunting after her motion-activated security camera caught footage of what appears to be a ghost coming to her door. Mini Patsashia, 46, was waiting for a parcel to be delivered to her home when footage was recording, and it appeared this kind of faint apparition emerge from a bench on the left of the screen. Then the figure crosses in front of the camera, almost appearing to look directly at it. It then passes out of view, moving to the right before the camera sensors stopped recording. And for those of you familiar with the favorite and famous Predator movie series, it has that look. Everything else is in relatively good focus, except for this thing stands up and starts to move, and you see this shimmer like a physical form moving around. It's really an interesting piece of video. I'd love for you guys to see. She's in Ontario, Canada, and she said, "My dog started barking and ran towards the door. I was awaiting a package, so I figured it was just the courier. Looking outside the large window opposite her front door, she could see that there was no one standing at the door or near the porch. Baffled, she dismissed her reservation, thinking her dog might have just heard a noise outside. Then I was turning around and going back to my kitchen. I received a notice on my phone that the doorbell alarm had been activated. So I looked at the video, and I said, 'What the heck is this?' She recalled she even had a psychic weigh in on it. The psychic said, 'Does the bench hold any significance?' I said, 'Why?' And they said, 'Well, the spirit looks like it was sitting on your bench. The bench was given to me by somebody that was very close to me and passed away, and the anniversary of his death is coming this week. He was my neighbor. I'd known him my whole life and had grown up across the street from him. And when my father passed away, he would always be there to help us. The conversation I had with him was always while sitting on that bench.'" So we've got that link up on midnightinthedesert.com. You can go and review the video for yourself. I'm curious what your thoughts are, and you can feel free to hit me up through the wormhole, or you can email me dave@midnightinthedesert.com and let me know your thoughts. It's that time of year again. For Leonidas, the meteor shower repeated annually in mid-November, it comes as Earth passes through a trail of debris left by the comet 55P Temple Tuttle, which orbits the sun once every 33 years. Earth will pass through the thickest part of the debris at 7 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, but the best time for viewing begins around 2 a.m. local time on Sunday after the waxing gibbous moon has set, per space.com. NASA, noting viewers should allow up to 30 minutes for their eyes to adjust to the darkness, predicts an average of about 15 meteors per hour will be visible and appear to come from the constellation Leo, hence the shower's name. However, it is actually better to view the Leonidas away from the radiant, NASA says, per NPR. They will appear longer and more spectacular from that perspective. So for you stargazers that are willing to get up a little early, and if you're not like Minnesota, you're not going to be under a cloak of fog and snow, you might be able to see something pretty spectacular. So go check that out. All right, speaking of something spectacular, we have touched on this on and off through our shows in the last few years. The Dyatlov Pass incident, a very strange incident with a lot of conjecture, stories, mysteries, and histories that surround this. And most times it's in passing that somebody talks about it on our show, spending no more than about 5 to 10 minutes on it, just talking about the weirdness of it. We've never had a chance to really fully explore the Dyatlov Pass incident. Well, we're going to do that this evening in the beginning of the show here. Joining us on the phone this evening is Teodora. Is this Hajiska? Am I saying that right?
Yes.
All right, great. Teodora, thank you for joining us. I appreciate you coming here to chat about the Dyatlov Pass. You, how are you familiar? When did this story come into your realm of knowledge?
I saw the movie Dyatlov Pass just by chance, and I just before I deleted it from my memory because it's not a good movie to get acquainted with this. Somebody mentioned that it's a real event, so I just typed Dyatlov Pass, and so much information. I just went through the wormhole, as you say. I just started learning about the case, and I was very frustrated because it's a complicated matter, and the sources were all in Russian. We're talking 6 years ago. So everything, and it has a lot of information. So I couldn't navigate myself through everything that I was reading, and there was no one place where everything is structured. And there are a lot of photos, visuals, maps, case files, a lot of information. So 6 years ago, just for the profit of my retaining all the information in my brain, I'm a web designer. I started putting everything together into a website. And till this day, everything that I encounter in Russian, I start translating and just putting it in its according place on the website. When I saw the movie, there is no movie that you can actually get the idea, because the Americans especially, they're used to not to read, but if everything could be explained in 2 hours, and they come with these preconceptions of what are they gonna read about or see. They always ask me about a certain theory, which if you read a book or see a movie, you will come to the answer before you even know what the question is. So 6 years I have been just doing mostly this, since I don't have anything else as a hobby or a full-time job. I'm a traveler. I do whatever my heart desires. I'm very lucky in this regard. So I'm a Dyatlov Pass freak and junkie, and that's all I think about. Even when I go in the mountain, because I'm a mountaineer, I always make references to that case. They really grow on me, and I have some special connection, because the reason I was watching this stupid movie is because I was recovering from my fifth operation after a car accident, and I ended up pretty much with traumas like one of the hikers that died in that event. So I have a flail chest, I don't have ribs, I have my scapula is like a chips. I had the only difference with Ludmila Dubidina is that a piece of my rib didn't pierce my heart, and that I had people around to help me. So this is where it started for me.
Well, let's take us back in history. February 2nd, 1959, there was a group of 9 hikers. Talk to me about these hikers, who these people were, and where were they setting off from, and where was the eventual destination?
Yeah, the events took place in the northern Ural Mountains. The Ural Polytechnical Institute had its sports club, and 10 hikers decided to file everything according to the committee, the plan, the schedule, they filed out their documents, and they applied for the they were given some provisions and the gear and everything and the permission to go. There were 10. One of them, and for the audience that is familiar with the story, I'm referring to Bienko. One was of them was not allowed to go. So at the last moment, one of the 10 was replaced with a very strange person. He's the mysterious person in this hike, who was 15 years older than the students. So basically there are 2 women, 20 and 22. The rest are Okay, five students, three former students, and the last one that came instead of Bianco is 38-year-old instructor in another sports club, the instructor of Kurovka Tour Base. So he, when they were told that somebody else is going to come, that they're not used to go to the mountains, they don't know, and it's with such a age gap, they were having some... it wasn't pleasant for them because they were looking so much to go to this track. It's a difficult track only in regards that it's during the winter. They had to carry very heavy backpacks. It was category 3 winter track, which is the highest category of this class. The sports tourism in 59 was in its infancy. There weren't any gear for security and safety, like ropes, crampons, or any even culture about that. And they were going to cover not such a high mountain. It was the final goal was Peak O'Thornton, and it's only 4,000 feet. In meters, that's 1,234 meters. Before that, they had another lower peak, which is now called Kulatsa Hill. And they had to cover 300 kilometers. But the difficulty of this trek came from the fact that they have no communication. At this time, there were the maps were banned because the Cold War. This is the premier was of the Soviet Union. It was Nikita Khrushchev. It wasn't as bad as Stalin and time had changed, but still it was the Cold War. So they were going almost like blindfolded. They knew they had drawing of the area. Nobody has ever been before there. And they knew that they will need 21 days to make the trek that they were planning. So they went their way. They started with a train. Then they took a bus, then open truck. And I'm mentioning the truck because one of these 10 people had sciatica, I think it was called, the nerve on the back.
Right.
Let me check. Yeah.
Now let me ask one thing real quickly, if I could, Teodoro, just to clarify. Was this a specific expedition? Was it scientific? Were they gathering research? Were they just adventurers out on a trek? I wasn't sure I picked up on how you said that.
Yeah, they had to cover a certain category in order for their characteristics as a tourist to be higher. So I don't know why do you actually do sports, just to explore. Oh, well, they have
all right,
to,
so this was more of a leisure and an exploration and tourism thing. This wasn't any kind of like... this wasn't an assignment. This wasn't something that that was, you know, part of a government program. This wasn't part of a school or educational program. This was just a group of travelers.
Well, they had, for example, the one with the sciatica. He was the so-called doctor of the group, but he came back after the open truck. He was supposed to gather some geological cores, like what kind of minerals and rocks and stones you can find in this area. Also, they were supposed to see how to sustain in this weather and these conditions and how people around live, but nothing really certain about gathering some information. They weren't assigned any such task. It was mostly leisure sport, yes.
Okay.
So they were supposed to go. So after the tent, he came back at the last possible moment when they were pulled by a horse-driven sled. And he went back with the sled because he couldn't walk anymore. On that point on, we don't have witnesses. But we still have the entries in the diaries, what happened to them. And so they had, on the 28th was of January, was their first day on independent walk, on ski. And they were traversing, and they were putting in the diaries what's happening to them, where did they pitch the tent, what they ate, how easy it was to lit the fire. There are a lot of pictures. And the entries end on the 31st of January. So we can only guess what happens after that. Now, from the perspective of the rest of the world, they just didn't show up when they were supposed to on the 12th of January. There were no telegram, no nothing. So after some time,
was this area known for
no
losing, you know, travelers, losing hikers? Was, you know, was that something that happened on a pretty regular basis?
It wasn't a route that was often traveled by any hikers. Actually, I don't know anybody that has been gone there from the same institute. I'm pretty sure there wasn't. And but there were legends. Or maybe the legends were created after this event became so popular. The final destination of Torten, it's now speculated that it means don't go there. Because on several occasions, the indigenous people, Mansi and other people, have told them don't go there. This is very normal for the people that live there not to go there, because there is nothing to do during winter, especially during winter there, when the weather is so bad and there are very strong storms and blizzards, and there are no written sources that say anything about that name. So Autorten is actually, there is indigenous name, the Windy Mountain. Kulatsaho, this is the mountain in the peak where their tent was pitched last, is called Death Mountain. Now the speculations are that this is called Death Mountain because nine Mansi hunters died there in mysterious circumstances or disappeared altogether, but there are no evidences, so no documents, no such thing. And the mountain, the word Kolot means dead or meager, because there is no hunt, there is no game, there is no animal, nothing grows there. And basically it's called Dead Mountain because nothing grows there. But now we call it, because of our case, the Mountain of the Dead or the Mountain of Death and all that. But no, just people occasionally got injured or died in the winter weather, and that's very normal for mountains during the winter season. Nothing more.
Do you have any idea how cold would it get up there during the winter months?
Minus 40, minus 50 Celsius.
Wow, that's cold. To even decide to go into this area, I mean, were they warned off by government officials or by the tourism board or anybody telling them, you know, maybe this isn't a good time of year for this?
That was the only reason why this hike was Category 3. During the summer, the most challenging element there are the mosquitoes and the flies. During the autumn or spring is the mud, because you have to go with very high shoes and... But there is nothing really interesting for the mountaineers there. And winter hiking and traversing is a special sport. They call it ski hiking. And the ski is the key element in this hike. They were skiers. And they sure went to many mountains during the summer, but they're higher and more interesting mountains that they can climb. On this area, there is nothing to do during other seasons. It's only interesting when there is a lot of snow, to go through the snow.
I guess their perception of interesting and mine are two different things. To go out in that kind of weather, in that kind of environment, unbelievable. But I guess it takes all kinds. All right, so they set off to make this trek. One of their original group cannot make it, so somebody is replaced. Where do they get this replacement from?
There are a lot of groups that hike, even in this region. So you can, I guess, apply for track a certain category for a certain duration. So this ninth member of Dyatlov group, called Zolotaryov, he was instructor in a tour base, and he needed a higher certification so he can get better pay. And he applied. He was actually approved to go with another group in close by mountain, actually. But once he heard that there is a shorter track of the same category, only for 21 days, he asked to be transferred to the other group because he wanted to come back earlier to go see his mother or some other reason. So that's how it is. Usually a leader of a group comes up with, like the meetup. A meetup member just decides to organize a track, and he says, okay, I need 10 people. He may invite personally some of the members. They apply to be excused from studies or from their university or where they work, because everything was very strict. And they get approval, and they join the group. This is how the group was formed. Only now the leader of the group could say no to some new member. The rest of the group, even if they had something against, they were just, complaining, but they couldn't reject a member if the leader agrees to take him. So Dyatlov didn't have anything against Zolotaryov, but Zolotaryov actually turned to be a very good fit to the group. He was very joyful and had a lot of jokes, and very important for this time is singing songs. So he knew songs that they haven't heard before, and he became very popular. And on all of the photos, you see him very smiling a lot. He was a little bit of a womanizer. There were girls in the group. He liked one of them. So he was a good fit. And also he had experience. For example, the only ice axe that they had was his ice axe. He was he survived the war. He had a lot of stories and a lot of life experience to share. And they let him.
He was all right. Now they're going to set off. We've only got just a few moments left together, about a minute and a half left together in this segment. But how long is this journey originally set for them to take? Were they supposed to be gone 3 days, 5 days, 10 days?
21.
21 days.
That includes the train. That includes the train, the truck, the sled, the everything. From 23rd, when they departed from their hometown, Sverdlovsk, to the day when they were supposed to send the telegram that they're back into the first village where there is a civilization and post office to send the telegram, 21 days.
And once they were setting off to do this hike part, how long was the hike itself supposed to last?
From the 28th, we'll take 5 days from that.
Okay, so they were supposed to go do this trek in a period of 5 days. And I don't want to get into the full story at this point,
no,
but how long? How
from the 21, meaning that they were supposed to hike 17, 18 days.
Okay, and all right. So there's a lot going on in the story. How many total hikers are now setting off?
Nine
hikers are setting off on this fateful journey to go out and try to gather information, travel through this this pass, and then report back. All right, we're going to take a break in just a few seconds. Let me remind everybody, check out MidnightInTheDesert.com this weekend. I've got two brand new Supernatural short videos. Nick Groff from the TV show Ghost Adventures, Paranormal Lockdown, and Ghosts of Shepherdstown shares a very interesting story about a place he says deeply impacted him in his understanding of the paranormal. Plus, he discusses shadow people. Elizabeth Saint from Ghosts of Shepherdstown is the other video and shares a chilling tale about taking a shower and being stalked by a ghost in her own home and bathroom. You can check out both of those videos this weekend by visiting midnightinthedesert.com. And while you're there, check out the banner for our guest and click on the link. You'll find all the information about her research, and more. It's all right there for you. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Midnight in the Desert. We're back. This is Midnight in the Desert. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this evening we're talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident. All right, Theodore, we're about to head off. They're about to make this journey. They've now set off. How quickly into this trek, according to their logs and records, do things start to go bad for the group?
Well, in the logs, there is no mentioning of any threat or anything to be going wrong. This is one of the mysteries, because they were coping pretty well with everything. Their backpacks were heavy. Some days were with poor visibility, but they were doing pretty well. Why don't I just go through how they were found? Because this will bring the mystery into the case. So far, nothing is mysterious. The last entry of the diary is so strange that we're so far from any civilization, and it's so cozy. We were too tired to lit the fire, but we ate inside the tent, and tomorrow we will try to build a cache to lift some of the products. And that's all. It's very poetic. There is nothing mentioning of any threat. Okay, so they don't appear.
Theodora, if I could get you to adjust, with your phone, I don't know if you're shuffling or moving or rubbing it against your chin or something, but I'm getting a lot of scraping noises and motion instead of just hearing you clearly. So I don't know if you could pull the microphone away from your mouth just a little bit as you talk to us so that we're not getting as much jostling.
All right. How's that?
Okay. Right there. Hello? It sounds fine. Yep. All right. Go ahead.
So they launched a huge search and rescue operation and found their tent pretty fast. On the 21st, they start the search. On 26th, they found the tent. Tent was very important because it was found sticking out of the snow. And one fact that kind of mesmerizes everybody, including me, is that their steps were visible going out of the tent barefoot.
All right. Now, how long did you tell me? I'm sorry again because of the poor connection. How long had they been missing when this was finally found?
They were supposed to report back on the 12th. Let's say nobody was expecting them on the exact date. So the launch was 9 days after they disappeared.
Okay.
Right? 21st. So they find the tent in a mess, shredded, torn, but everything seems to be inside. The first mistake that they do is they make some more holes into the tent to get in because they were looking for live people or somebody with injuries, but nobody believed that they were dead. So they tore some more of the tent and start rummaging inside. It wasn't treated as a crime scene. Then they saw the footprints. The footprints are of people going in their socks down the slope. And there were counted 7-8 pairs of footsteps. So all of them were going down. What is more even interesting is that they were going not in one after another, as you would go in the snow, because it's more convenient if the first one makes the footsteps, but they were going abreast, one next to another, in an earshot distance from each other. And they were in their socks. But nobody was falling, stumbling. Nobody was dragged as if injured. They were going on their own accord, very orderly, down the slope. Not from the way they came up, but going down on the other way, where there was nothing expecting them because they left some products on the left, on the right, but they went to the left. Now, the forest to the left was closer, so if they were looking for a shelter, that would be the closest place, but it turned out that, that was taking place at the dead of night, so they were not seeing anything. They were not seeing any forest, any tree, no tree line, so they were... the reason that they were going in that direction is not clear to anybody. But they were going very calmly. That was the first encounter of the hikers. And they continue in a very chaotic way to look for them. They were thinking, I don't know what they were thinking, but if they were going without their skis and furthermore in their socks, they were not looking for live people, and the Mansi that were helping the searchers were clear on that, so they were really keeping away from them. The searchers, the first night when they found the tents, because they pulled some of the products, they found the alcohol. I'm not saying that this is very typical for the nationality, but it's indicative of the contamination of the crime scene, because they pulled items from the tent, they drank the alcohol of the hikers for their well-being, and the Mansi said, no, they're dead. You should not drink for their health and life, and they almost beat them because of that, because they didn't believe they're going to find their friends dead. Well, they did. Next day, they found four of them. Next interesting finding in this case is the cedar tree. It's a big tree in the forest line where they found the first two bodies. They were laid next to each other in a respectful poses, like from their friends, but they were half naked. Not only everybody went out of the tent with no shoes, no jackets, no skis, no nothing, but also they continue taking clothes from each other. So the first two bodies were really with their bare skin from the waist down. And they didn't seem to have any traumas or blood or anything on them. It was very weird because they just looked like somebody, they died from hypothermia and somebody took their clothes. This is what they look like. Same day, a little bit further back, going up the tent, they encountered two more bodies. And they were in a dynamic pose as if they were trying to go back to the tent. Their heads were pointing to the tent, and they were their feet were folded as if they were resisting high wind, trying to stay in place or just fallen down and curved into a position from the freezing weather to warm themselves. And so we have four bodies so far. They seem to be undressed and dying from hypothermia. After one more week, they found the fifth body. This is the first body that has a sign of trauma on his skull. It's a trauma that you can walk with, but eventually you're going to have some problem if it doesn't get treated. There was a skull, a piece of the skull was caved in. And those are the five bodies that were found in the first month. Nothing else was found. Then the tent continued to be examined. Everybody was talking about, the first impression was as if they were sucked by a hurricane from the tent. And the body, I don't know how you can suck out the bodies but leave all the products and the gear and everything else. But this is what they were saying. They were so strong of a blizzard that they were sucked out from the tent. So the tent was folded. First, everything was taken out. Tent was folded. The skis that were laid at the bottom of the tent were taken out. And only then the investigator and the prosecutor came to look at the crime scene and make the protocol of the items that were found there. So right there we have nothing that is reliable as a document, as a subjective data of what was going on around the tent. Also, only thanks to that they were barefoot and they compressed the snow under them with higher temperature, that was the only reason that the footprints were preserved. And the only thing that we know that was left the way it was from the hikers, because the winds blew the snow around the footprints and they were staying like pillars embossed 40 centimeters up. That's quite impressive. And they were just staying there, so they couldn't tramp on top of them without seeing them, so they photographed the steps of the hikers. Next thing, they were thinking the Mounsey did it, because who else is there in the region? But none of the food, shoes, the alcohol, or the money was touched. Everything was left intact. And they were still questioning the Mounsey when by chance they found out, by chance, because a seamstress entered into the room where the tent was hung for inspection, she said that the tent is cut from inside. Dave?
Yeah, so the tent appears, sorry if you're having trouble, we're getting some static on the line, so I'm muting my microphone in between so we're not getting this echo back. So it looks as though the tent has been torn from the inside out.
Not only torn, but cut with at least two knives. And this is changing the course of the investigation, because everybody was thinking that they were having their meal and preparing to go to bed, and somebody attacked them from outside. That's the normal that you would think when you see the tent. But they found out that the tent was cut from inside and the tent was sent for professional examination, and it was confirmed that that's the case. So somebody cut the tent from inside, and they start thinking that actually avalanche, something scared them off, something very alarming happens for them to cut through the tent, not to have the time to use the exit. The exit in this tent was basically a sheet that was hanging from an opening. It had kind of a toggle to button the tent, but we cannot be sure if it was buttoned or opened. But anyway, the tent was cut in a way that you can just go out through the opening. And so everybody started thinking
with that
about
in mind. With that in mind, yeah. Were there any defensive wounds on any of the victims, I shouldn't say victims because we don't really know what happened to them, but were there any defensive wounds as though any of them may have been in a knife fight or have fought something off during any of this time?
Dave, you have to understand that every fact and every answer is controversial. Yes. Most 50% of the people will say, if you read the autopsy reports, that those are defensive wounds because the knuckles of their hands, there were bruises on their faces. One of the girls had on her waist a bruise that it's like from what the cops are using, button, what do you call that thing, the stick that they're using to beat the crowd?
Billy clubs.
Yes, something like that. So I would say that those are defensive wounds. But they could be from crushing branches with their bare hands or something else. Something I thought is definitively a defense wound. I was people argued with me in my forum that that's not the case. And I asked doctors and they said that possibly this is not a broken nose. For example, the autopsy report says that the nose of one of them had unusual mobility. But what do you make of that? I made broken nose, but then the doctor said there should be bruising, there should be bleeding inside. I said, well, if the body is 3 months, has been in the elements for 3 months, how would the broken nose exactly look like? The cartilage, if it's a stretch. So everything is very controversial. You would read on half of the sources that those are defensive wounds, but the ambassadors of the natural causes like avalanche, force majeure, calamity, UFOs, what's up not, they will say, no, those are not. So to me, some of the bruises on the face looked like defensive wounds, but it's arguable. I don't know. You can read the autopsy report, ask the doctor's opinions, and make your own mind, because this case is so full of ambiguity and things. Even to this day, we don't even have a certain DNA on the exhumation that happened a couple of months ago.
They now, one of the injuries, if I could ask real quickly, one of the injuries seemed very strange to me, if I remember. They said that the injuries and internal injuries that one of the people had, at least one of them that I remember, was this internal crushing. And it was though it had been hit by some kind of impact without leaving exterior bruising, but crushing blow inside, almost like they'd been hit by a car. Was there any explanation that you're aware of that made any kind of sense of that injury?
Fast forward 2 months, they find the last four bodies. The last four bodies actually made the case, well, if not for murder, at least three of these people were said to be killed not by humans. I mean, human cannot cause these injuries. This is what the doctor that made the autopsy report said, that the injuries of these bodies are so great and so the impact is so strong that it cannot be caused by human. It had to be caused from a very high fall, from very high, or hit by a car. Well, he said, for example, he knows that there is no car there. The last four were found with injuries on their, two of them had flailed chest, multiple line fractures on their ribs, like we're talking 10 ribs. On the other one were four ribs in two lines. So this is a flailed chest. That will leave you right there. You can move. You can survive without any assistance. And the third one had caved in skull, which will render him absolutely unconscious and basically dead in hours. This is what the doctor said about these injuries. So they started looking for a cause for this trauma, and to this day I cannot find explanation, and this is what's intriguing me. And this is the main flaw of most of the theories, because no matter what you say is the cause of their behavior, what chased them out of the tent, what caused them to behave like they did, because you see that they parted in three separate directions. Two of them died under the tree. Three of them tried to go back to the tent, which is also arguable, because one of them could have died on his way from the tent down, and two of his friends to have gone to look for him. And then the last four, they made deliberate attempt to survive the night. And they had good chances, because they built a den, they laid branches, they gathered clothes from their dead friends, and they didn't even had all the clothes that they gathered on them. They had them laid down to sit on them. And they were found dead not inside the den, but 20 meters from the den. So what do you make out of this? If they hit in the den, they could just curve and die there from hypothermia. Other theories said that they built the den on top of a grotto, because this is a stream of a river. And if it eats the snow underneath, from your weight or whatever, you can actually collapse the snow. And one of the theories is that the fall was so great, 5 meters, that the collapsed snow on top of them suffocated them and caused this flailed chest and crushing. But they were not even in the den. They were, like, going out further, running from something. And also you cannot, from falling, you cannot have this this kind of trauma, neither from a lot of snow on top of you. And I can't explain. I haven't heard a single explanation of this trauma so far. Svetlana also says that Mansi induced in a trance of mushrooms or something else jumped on their chest, which to me is... I can't imagine this happening. First of all, if you're laying on a soft snow and somebody is jumping on top of you on your rib cage, you can cause this trauma. You can cause local breakage of the ribs. This has to be a very huge flat surface that presses on top of a human.
And you don't think it could have been part of an avalanche? I know that's been a big, one of our other guests believes that is it without a doubt, that it was an avalanche. It caused the interior damage after the people had frozen to death and had caused that. And as it thawed, that's what kept cracking ribs and creating the under the skin crushing.
This friend, did he say that these injuries happened because the avalanche has to be on the top of the slope? They're a mile down in forest where there is no avalanche there. First, there are no signs of avalanche at all in the area. They could have made some more data, the research and sent for, because you can tell if the slope is prone for avalanche, if there has been an avalanche, and this is very easy to be determined, but they didn't do any of this. But there was no avalanche on the slope. The tent was sticking out. The only thing that could have happened is a slab of snow that had buried the tent into snow and chased them out of the tent, which would explain them cutting out their way of the tent, looking at the tent in their socks and thinking, well, what can we do? The tent, we can't even dig it out. Let's go down to the forest. Okay, let's say if that happened and they were talking between each other, if there is an avalanche, nobody will stay in the way of the avalanche and go in the river dance line next to each other. You run in all directions. You stumble. You fall. You're in panic. If there is an avalanche, they wouldn't have fleeing the way they did. So peacefully walking in a line. Then these injuries that you mentioned happened 3 hours after they left the tent. So somebody is saying that they left the tent because of something. They lit the fire. They start dying. Then the last four made the den, cuddle up, and the avalanche fell. But the avalanche cannot fall in the place where they were found. They were found between the trees in a creek. And no sign of avalanches around.
Now, it's also been said that the reason that some of them were found without clothing is part of hypothermia. You actually kind of reverses. You start to feel like you're on fire and you're burning up. So people will be known to remove clothing. Did they see signs of that or anything that would let them believe that that might be the legitimate response to why their clothes were removed?
I can argue with that with a strong argument, because the clothes were taken only by those that were still alive. Clothes were always taken from the ones that were already dead. And, for example, the first two under the tree, from them were taken most of the clothes because they were almost naked. And people were taking their sleeves and parts of the pants and were wrapping their bare foot with the clothes that were torn from their dead friends. So people were not dropping the clothes, like just spreading them around, because it's a paradoxical undressing happening here. But they were torn from each other to make amends to their lack of clothing. They were actually wrapped around the limbs of the still alive hikers. So it's not the paradoxical undressing signs that they were speculating.
But all right, well, we're up against a break. We're up against a break, Teodoro. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like you to talk to me about some of the facts that you think have been hugely blown out of proportion, and then talk to me about your theory on this. What happened, in your opinion, from reviewing the evidence that was left behind, the diaries and the accounts at the time? Stay tuned. We've got more to cover as the Dyatlov Pass incident, evidence revealed, continues here on Midnight in the Desert. All right, we're back. This is Midnight in the Desert. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and we are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident. We've been having some issues with our audio. I think we've reconnected. Hopefully this will be a better connection for us. Teodoro, Jessica is our guest this evening as we talk about this very strange incident that took place in 1959 when nine hikers who set off for a trek vanished and were found in different states of death and in different ways. It's a very strange and unusual story. Teodoro, let's start taking a look at the facts that have been kind of blown out of proportion throughout all of this story. What are some of the ones that you've heard people say, well, this happened or that happened, but you can definitely eliminate?
Hi. How is now the sound?
That's better. Thank you.
Well, one of the first visuals that people that look for Dyatlov Pass will encounter is, of course, the Yeti picture. History Channel managed to boil down this case to a snowman, Bigfoot, that eliminated all of the hackers based only on an out-of-focus photo frame of the camera of one of the hikers. And he was the Joker one. He liked to pose in front of the camera, his own camera. He was giving it to his friends and was posing and joking and falling. And if you take the photo in question in the context of the surrounding, the previous frames, he was going to relieve himself into the woods. I mean, this is what the three previous pictures show. And then is him very far between the trees, out of focus, and History Channel made the movie Yeti Lives, the Russian Yeti Lives, and this is what you're going to see. One of the versions is that Bigfoot killed them.
Now, so you're saying that whatever this image is that they captured was just one of the guys being a prankster. He had posed this picture. It was nothing that it appears to be.
Well, basically, the photo is out of focus. He was a prankster, but didn't mean to make a photo that looks like Yeti. And another fact that it's always goes with this theory is that they had a flyer, like a leaflet with jokes. In this leaflet, you can read jokes like can nine hikers be warmed with three blankets, or the new world record for assembling a stove, because they were carrying a portative stove with them made by Dyatlov himself. So it was a question of how easy and fast they put it together. Anyway, there were jokes like Professor of Love, Dubinina, and what so on. And then one of the titles was, we're in the area where Yeti lives. And this is all part of the jokes. And combined with this out-of-focus picture is the theory, gave birth to the theory of the Yeti. And the whole movie is based on this, actually claiming to be somehow based on facts. The next photo, which is more serious because a lot of Russians talk about it, is the last photo from one of the hacker scammers again, that was not presented initially because it's the shot that you make when you take out the film. Before you take out the film, you just make one last click without even pointing the camera at anything, just to make sure that this is the last frame of the film. And it's usually a very dark frame of nothing in it. But if you happen to have a source of light, they all look the same, a smudge of light in the middle and black around it. So a lot of theories are based on this frame being a shot of a shrapnel of a rocket or the eye of the beast or UFO or I don't know, something very awful. But this is a technical shot and initially wasn't even presented because they did it before taking the film out of the camera. Oh my God, when it came to the net, the theorists were swerving like from a crazy hive about this frame. Next things are the fireballs in the sky that you will see in the case files, that there are three reports from meteorological stations of events, light events being seen in the sky, which is very normal for these areas. You know, of the northern glow and things, a lot of things glow in the sky. There are also sounds, and there are theories about that, of course, because people feel anxiety. Until now, you can find people that testify about not feeling comfortable and wanting to flee certain areas that around where that happened, which combined with the fact that it's not a very welcoming surrounding and environment with there are strange things happening to the compass in this area and magnetic fields and so on. So, yeah, a lot of things are happening in the sky. But the theories say that ultrasound, like the noise of there is a whole book based on the theory of the wind making sounds that drive you crazy. But you...
Right, that infrasound.
The infrasound.
Right.
Yes. We have to keep in mind that this whole tragedy happened in the span of hours. It did not happen at the same time, everybody going mad and dying at the same time. It started from the 10th. They were out. They start going down. They lit a fire. So far, we have 1 hour. The cedar had the size of broken branches to the altitude of 5 meters, which looked, and they were facing where the tent was, in the direction of the tent. To me, this looks like somebody climbed up and fell, because under one of the bodies under the cedar, there were branches as if they were broken under his weight when he was falling from the tree. And to me, not just to me, it looks like they were climbing up to look at the tent. Another explanation is that they were climbing up to hide from somebody. But so far, we're having 2 hours because a lot of work was done around the cedar tree to gather branches for the fire. There is another theory. Why were they cutting branches from the trees where there are so many dry wood on the floor? They must be blind. They must have been poisoned. They must be crazy. Well, you gather branches not only to lit the fire. There are 9 people. You usually step on branches or sit on branches when you're barefoot or naked. That's a common practice. And this is what they did for the den. So cutting branches from the trees is not only mad and crazy, but this is a very good strategy to survive the night. So far we're having more than 2 hours. What can cause the group to split Obviously, they were not very warm because we see that some of them were trying to put their hands and feet into the fire and they had very bad burns. But they were doing so far good. They were together. They were around the fire inside the forest. And everybody that has been in the area says that the wind really dies down in the forest. There is no wind. So you can imagine, they were together and they were cutting branches and lighting a fire. There is no immediate danger here. Whatever happened at the tent is gone, they think is gone, and they have pretty good chances of survival. Then three of them started towards the tent. My theory is that actually one of the three didn't make it to the fire and was hit in the head by the butt of a gun, and he collapsed while they were going down to the forest, and they just noticed that he's not there anymore. Well, it was a call of the leader to decide who to go up to look for him. But the fact is that one of the girls that didn't have any inner shoes or no footwear whatsoever, while two of the other ones did have footwear, they could have given her some footwear, not shoes, but more serious inner socks, thick socks. She started going up to the tent. Let's say Dyatlov went after her to make sure that she returns safely. Well, he died too. Then two dead under the cedar, two dead going towards the tent. If there was some danger at the tent, why would they go towards the tent? We have the last four remaining. And so far, there are 3 hours passed from the first initial event at the tent that made them go down. Now they have time to build the den. And we see things gathered on their way to the den. And that den is not very far from the tree. So they're making their way to the digging the hole. They don't have anything to dig with, so it's with their bare hands, but basically tramping the snow, putting branches, putting clothes. And then something is taking them 6 meters or something like that, 10 meters away from that den, and kills them in a horrible way. There it is. It's not all of them with the same traumas. It looks like a tree has fallen down and hit three of them lined like ducks. So we have crushed chest, and one caved in skull. But the fourth one doesn't have injuries. Actually, Dave, are you still with me?
Yes, I am. Just listening to you. I don't want to interrupt while you're in the midst of a run.
Good, good. I don't want to waste my story here. The last one that I'm mentioning now, the last one to die, is Kulevatov, who had a birthday today. And I chose this date because he has a birthday today. And I publish new articles and new photos and new the stories and facts about each of them on their birthday. So Kulevatov, I think that he died last because he was with the least injuries. And he was embracing one of the hikers, the 38-year-old, as if he was making him warm, protecting him, or somehow helping him. And the one that he was helping was wearing women hat and coat. One of the girls that was dying very close to him, like 30 centimeters from him, from similar flail chest trauma, the one that the rip pierced her heart, was, let's say, already dead. So Kulevatov, I think, took the clothes from her and put them on Zolotaryov, who was also dying, but more slowly, slower than Dubinina. And he was trying to warm him up. And this is how they died, basically. The fourth one was with caved in skull, so I think he was dead already. So Kulevatov was the last one. I don't know what I would do if everybody else is dead, but if somebody was Okay, so here is my, actually, this is not my theory. This is Rakitin's, Alexei Rakitin is the best book on the events.
And let me just mention one thing real quickly. There is the image we were talking about, the Bigfoot image, is up at midnightinthedesert.com. If you go there and look on tonight's guest banner and see Teodora's banner there, you'll be able to click on it. It'll take you in. You can see the photograph. Just scroll down and you'll see the image that is known as the Bigfoot or Yeti photograph. All right. So this is where we're getting ready to talk about the theory of what actually may have occurred. And you said this isn't your theory. Who bandied this theory out there?
Yes, the author that made the best analysis, and actually that's my recommendation, is the only source that you should start to read about the event, but it's not translated. That's why I'm slowing down, so I can't help about that. I know, okay. Russian. It was just published in German. Actually, I was wondering why it's not published in English. He makes a very good analysis of everything, the time, the place, the characteristic of the hikers, their relationship, their emotions. He goes into details like who shot more landscape and what does it say about his emotional state, who liked who. He makes, it's a great book. So he says the following, but still his theory has a flow too. So I mean, his theory is the staged KGB agent thing, just to jump to. He says that three of them, or two at least, were KGB agents, double spies that were supposed to meet with CIA and give them contaminated clothes, because on the top of the whole mess and his mystery, we have radioactive clothing. Three pieces of clothing are radioactive. Nobody knows why. Well, they could have come from their places of work, but why are they wearing them? They know very well what does it mean for them. And you wouldn't put radioactive pants if you're 21 year old, would you? Knowing that it's radioactive.
I don't know that I don't know at any age I'd put on radioactive pants.
maybe
I'm just a stick in the mud, right?
Yeah, maybe to glow in the dark to make their ways. Anyway, Alexei Rakitin says that they actually had to meet the CIA agents, and they met without the leader of the group knowing what's going on. But the CIA were somehow suspicious that something is not right, and they killed them. But the rest of the book is great. So Rakitin says that somebody, to make 9 people come out of the tent and not... Without any resistance, they had to be armed, and they had to be more than one, because we have 7 young men who are full of adrenaline. They were in the top shape. They're fit. They're really strong, and they didn't have any health problems, or they were not tired. They had walked only 2-3 hours that day, so there was no reason to believe that they were incapacitated in any way. They were just eating. They found their loin cut. And,
anyway. Right, but it is negative 40 Celsius, you said. So, you know, 3 hours walking in that kind of weather will draw a lot more of the energy out of you. It can weaken you, and especially if they've been at it for a number of days. I don't think we should just summarily dismiss those aspects of the physicality of just how hard a trek like this could be.
Well, what about the other party, the CIA agents? They're not with helicopters or anything. They would be tired too. But so the theory is that this is a fact, actually, that somebody went out to pee to relieve themselves. There are traces of 2 men going out. And 2 of the hikers have inner boots. This is something you put inside the ski boot. And this is exactly the way you go out to pee. You put something, not the boots, but something. So there are traces of something. And then there are these photos in the damaged camera of one of the 4 found in the creek. They found him with the camera around his neck. Now, imagine going down, surviving, panic, avalanche, something major, and you put a camera on your neck. So my theory, and I read it from Rakiti. No, actually, this I don't know if I read it from somebody, but I'm almost sure that when they were relieving themselves, they saw something in the sky. And it's very normal because it happened to the rest of the searchers and parties that were looking for them, of the duty man who was on watch outside during the night to see something in the sky and to call the people from inside the tent. And this is exactly what they did. They came out in their underpants and underwear, the way you sleep in the tent, and you try to step on broken branches and to look up in the sky. Because if you take time to put clothes and shoes, it's going to disappear. So I think Zolotaryov grabbed his camera. And there are some frames from this damaged camera that show, at least one of the frames, shows something in the sky and three heads. So he was shooting something in the sky behind the backs of his friends. I think they were just watching something in the sky, and I think somebody was watching them. And this is how they happened to be outside the tent in this undressed state, and they were marched to go down the slope to die. I think somebody got them out of the tent and marched them down to die. That's the only way I can explain the way that they were going down towards the forest. And they didn't want to go where they left the products and everything because not maybe they were told which direction to go or just because the forest was closer or anyway, it was easier to go to the left. Then they destroyed the tent. Whoever attacked them at the tent went in and cut pieces of the tent to watch them go down. And I think the mistake was for the hikers to lit the fire because whoever attacked them stayed in the tent and watching them go down, they saw the light of the fire. You could see it. And I think they went down to finish them. This is how maybe some of them hid that how they parted. I think the two bodies that were found under the cedar were actually finished one way or another by sitting on top of their chest because one of them had gray foam coming out of his mouth. This can happen of pulmonary edema, which can be caused by freezing your lungs. You start spitting actually foam and blood, but also it could be caused by somebody sitting on your chest. But let's say one of them was up on the tree, it froze and fell down, crushing all the branches underneath him. The other one was left to die. There are no traces of these two to be hit very badly and killed by somebody else. But what happened to the rest? Three of them are in the dark trying to crawl back to the tent. And then we have a woman hit on the back, so maybe they caught to her and hit her. But they were very helpless because the adrenaline wore down. This is a known practice, how to kill somebody with hypothermia. You don't let them know at the beginning that they'll be exposed to the elements. They think that they got away, even if they're just left in a cold room or something. They don't know how long this is going to take. At the beginning, it looks like they're going to survive it. And then slowly, they're just energy and everything starts leaving them and they're becoming incapacitated. So this is what looks like the first five died from. This is how they died. But somebody helped them to chase them in a place where they couldn't get any to hit themselves or to get any help. Now, what happened to the last four? They had all the chances to survive. Why did they die? Nothing was falling on top of them. There was no chance of any force majeure or act of God or any They said that they died of misadventure, which is not assessing your risks. But everybody would tell you that to survive in the cold winter in the mountain, if you get to the forest, you dug yourself a hole in the snow, lay branches. This is how you survive a night in the winter. And they had the chances. So what? These traumas are really horrific. And I can tell you by myself that you cannot move after being with so many crushed ribs, caved skull. So right. My theory is that that attack actually unfold in three instances. First at the tent, then at the fire, because they saw the fire, and then they finished the last four because they had to finish them because it was taking too long. And then again, if they were armed with automatic weapons, because I can't explain any other way to overcome 9 young, strong people, why didn't they just shoot them? Everybody.
Theodora, we have to take a break. We'll continue that part of the discussion when we return, as we continue to look at evidence regarding the Dyatlov Pass incident right here. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Midnight in the Desert. Through the Dyatlov Pass, as we re-examine some of the evidence, the stories, the histories, and mysteries, Theodora Hadjiska is our guest this evening. And I do want to address real quickly, I know I've had a few people saying, Dave, are you listening? Are you there, Dave? In the first hour, we were having a lot of audio connection issues, and I was getting bounce back as long as my microphone was open. So I was hearing it in a bounce back loop, so I would mute so that I could actually hear what she was saying and then come in when I could. And I'm continuing that just so I can focus on what the guest is saying. I'm hearing everything along with all of you. But as you see, she's a very dedicated storyteller. And the problem is on her side, when you go for a while talking through these compressed lines, it works much like a walkie-talkie. Sometimes it sounds like maybe you've disconnected or you've lost. She's just double-checking exactly. To make sure she hadn't lost me on the line here. We're all good. We're both connected. It's just that I'm giving her due and focusing on the story, because there are so many different elements to this, so many different things to examine, and sometimes 2 hours is not enough. All right, we're back into this as we're discussing the different aspects of this case. You mentioned earlier, and I want to mention one thing. One of the listeners brought up to my attention that wasn't one of the women, one of the people in the expedition, their tongue was removed?
Yeah, what do you mean by removed? We have from the autopsy reports that it was missing. It doesn't say if it's cut, although you could say if it's cut with a knife. It was just missing. Same with her eyeballs. The eyeballs of another man found near her in the creek also were missing. She was found with her face down, buried into water, into creek. The same pose that you would take if you pray, kneeled by your bed. This is how they found her. So her face was in the creek. And I won't speculate for 3 months what can happen with tissues if you're in a stream. But I have seen many forensic files, and some of them have educational purposes of telling you what are the latest methods of finding things. And in one of them, they found the body of a boy, and it was thought to be a sexual assault because a lot of soft tissues were missing, which turned out that some animals, some life into the stream is feeding on soft tissue. This is during the winter. I really don't know what kind of life exists in this altitude and longitude, but this could be researched. And I don't want to jump into, oh, she was really a big mouth, because this is what she was. She was the supply manager, and she was, even in the diary, says, oh, I'm evil like a devil, and why I'm in such a bad mood. And she was really opinionated, and they said, well, somebody had enough and cut out her tongue. Actually, they said that the perpetrators, she may have confronted them, and that's why they did. No, I don't think so. I think this is just natural decay. And we're trying to make it so much more mysterious, as if what happened to these people is not enough. So we have to gouge their eyeballs and cut their tongues now.
You've got to walk us through the possibility that it was an espionage hit. So I don't think we're so far removed from believing that some of these things could have taken place.
Yeah, but espionage, you preserve your strength. Why go through such extreme the mutilation of the bodies? And obviously, whoever attacked them, they were preserving their energy. They wanted them to die from hypothermia. They chased them, and they didn't die. So they had to go down and try to kill them, sit on their chest and frighten them and leave them for a couple more hours to die. They still don't die. So they were not really after going full-blown mutilation and killing spree from the very beginning. They just had to end it so they can go home, because this is taking a whole night to go find them and kill them. And now, if you have spent all this time to kill 9 people, and the last ones you will take the time to cut their tongues and gouge their eyes. Although, right, honestly, somebody to go after these young people and kill them must be disturbed. I can't say that it's totally out of possibility, because right, this has to be a sick mind to go to such extremes and kill them. Because I think they really saw that there is a good chance for them or some of them to survive. They wanted them dead, but I can't fathom why. No, I can't say anything. I don't have theory about that. My only theory, actually, I don't have a theory, but the fact that I am absolutely positive 100% is that somebody helped them die. Somebody helped them die. They wanted to help them just to die from the weather exposure, from the elements, but they had to finish them because the last 4 would have lived.
Could it be, you know, with some of the soft tissue and things like eyes, tongue, lips, you know, were there other markings on any of the humans from possible animals, scavengers, you know, whether you've got coyotes, wolves, moose, squirrel, whatever might be just nibbling on them throughout, you know, the kind of like a human popsicle for them?
No whatsoever. This eliminates a Yeti or any scavengers. Even after they were dead, there were no markings of any animal presence on them. No clawing, no biting, no missing tissue, no tears, nothing like that.
Okay, we've got very little time left together in exploring this case. So you think this was some kind of form of espionage, something like that that took place? Do you think this was just a renegade killer that they came across that was picking him off slowly, or do you think that it could have been some of the other campers that some of the other trekkers that were doing this?
There was another group, but not too close to them. They were planning actually to meet them on their way back if they made the whole loop. There was nobody seen around, and those are areas where you had to go through limited number of villages. There is no other way to go there. Somebody would have seen them, and there are no sightings of strangers or anything. They combed the Mansi yurts. Nobody was around. I don't believe that the hikers attacked each other. There were no, well, one of the hikers actually had some relationship with one of the girls, and then they parted, and then there are speculations that the leader liked that same girl. But just for this reason, that there is no any kind of sexual conflict there, the girls were they were virgin. They were not sleeping with anybody. So they didn't have a boyfriend or anything, none from the hikers. And in their diaries, they said that basically all the guys are cool and nothing was going on. They kept very emotional diaries about their feelings. I can mention, since we have a little time left, Kulevatov, that was born on this date, for some reason celebrated his birthday on the trek, which is not in November. And everybody, so in one of the diaries, it says, oh, Sasha has a birthday today, and we gave him a tangerine. The opinionated Luda that night was confronting everybody who should stitch the tent because it was very worn down. So she was angry again and she went to sleep. So she was left without a piece of tangerine. This is a famous scene, the tangerine that they parted. This is like the last fruit that they parted 2 days before they died. So why did Kulevatov say that has a birthday on that date? We don't know. Then we have sightings. Everybody makes up stories. And if you have to go back and say what is a fact and what is not, a testimony by a witness should be a fact. So we have a lot of the pilots that were transporting the bodies from the Holatsikul mountain. Some of them say even before the tent was found, on the day before it was found, we saw a tent with two bodies next to it. And then on top of this, the radiograms from that, there are no radiograms from that date. They're from the day before, they're from the day after. They said that they reported the tent and the bodies, but there is no such communication, and the tent was found after that. And there were no bodies found around the tent. Another weird testimony is from a nurse in Ivdel, where the morgue was, the bodies were transported to that morgue. She accounts for a lot more bodies that these hikers were. She, at least 11, she had seen at least 11 bodies to be brought, and she personally washed them. She cut their clothes that were muddy. She washed the bodies and prepared them for autopsy. This is impossible because the autopsy reports start with the clothing of the bodies and how, if they were buttoned, not buttoned, what is in their pockets. So they wouldn't allow a nurse to remove their clothes and wash them. And we have a lot of testimonies like that. And everybody is asking me, well, what about this and that? And I have to go back to the sources. Usually those are interviews by periodicals or the Dyatlov Foundation, the interviews. I translate them and I just post them and say, make up your own mind. Is this a testimony of a very old person who doesn't remember very much and it's confused by his own words that she said yesterday? Do you think we have to take it in consideration? How about the last exhumation? Now, what will happen with this case is that something needs to be brought to light to make the grounds for a claim, the case to be reopened. But they tried with one exhumation of the body of Zolotaryov. This is the 38-year-old, because he wasn't even registered to be buried where he's supposed to. So the underlining idea for more than 3 years of Komsomolskaya Pravda, so it was that maybe if we don't find the body or something is not as it's in the autopsy reports, we will have a grounds to reopen the case. And we just witnessed the greatest circus in the media that you can imagine. They exhumed the poor body. And they made a very good skull, when you have a picture of the skull and a picture of the person, super exponation of the skull and the picture, and you say how many points match, and you can say if that's the person from the photo.
Right, just the points of references and mapping it out. Right.
And it was good. I mean, the Nikitin, who is a very prominent forensic scientist, he matched the skull with the photo, and we were sure it's Zolotaryov. Then the examination of the bones, the fractures, everything was in place. And then suddenly, Channel 1, the Russian Channel 1, made the broadcast with the DNA test result that this is not Zolotaryov. And everything went. So can you imagine what are we talking about if the bodies that were buried are not the people that we're talking about, and these fractures happen to people and the bodies were replaced? I mean, we're going the full-blown conspiracy here. And then, of course, a second DNA test was made in the best, the central laboratory, forensic laboratory in the Russian Federation, and the match came that it's him. But still on Wikipedia and a lot of sources, it says that the DNA doesn't match any living relative. So what happened here? They start speculating that that person who is in the photo is actually taken after the war, and during the war, Zolotaryov was replaced with somebody else, but then he came back to live with his mother, and his mother didn't recognize him, or how will that happen? And all these speculations continue to now. Mm-hmm. It's an active competition, conquest, somebody to find something about this case.
Weren't there a lot of lights that were sighted around that time, which people have referred to as UFO lights, and some other activity that were, you know, that during that time were also being witnessed on different parts of the mountain and around that range?
Yeah, I mentioned it that there are even two documents in the case files from meteorological stations that they have been seeing some lights in the sky. And also the searchers asked officially what is going on, if there are any experiments in the sky, because they're worried if they're safe. There were a lot of lights in the sky, but that's normal. I have people that have shared in the forum that they have been visited or live in these places, and that's an absolutely normal view in the sky, to lights to go, come and go, and exactly what they explained. But there is no instance of anybody to be harmed from these lights. There is a lot of talking and publication of lights coming toward you. Even I have, and nothing happens. They come toward you and they go someplace. Even there are Russian people that are writing me letters that they had a beard, they woke up and they're burnt and they saw lights. Even without the part about the beard, there are a lot of lights. But you cannot count a light to be the source of the trauma. Okay, I agree. The military says that there were no experiments in the area of nothing could be accounted to have fallen on that place. And it's question of what can be proved. We have to find the document or somebody to say something that has happened. Just speculating on top of theories and versions. Everybody is talking about this case, and everybody like now says, what about this or that? We have to find hard evidence. Yes, there were lights. And what follows from that? What do we do with that fact that there were lights?
Right. And I understand that aspect. I mean, that's just part of the legend and lore, though. I mean, there were so many possibilities of what, you know, people believed. Was this alien? Was it secret weapons testing? Did this group just happen to stumble upon an area where they were doing military training, and the military just went about it as though this was part of the training and, you know, entered into this? Was there a Yeti attack? You know, was it just madness by human error and the weather? you know, there's all of that. That's why I said it's such a fascinating story and so multi-layered. There's so many different aspects to the possibilities and or probabilities of what may have actually taken place.
Just to mention, there were no signs of burning of any trees. If there was explosion, there should be signs somewhere, anywhere, of something to be burned. There is no crater, there is nothing. And there were a lot of aerial searches in the area. They should have seen it from above. No documents or testimonies of anything to be blown anywhere around the hikers.
I've gotten an email here with a couple of questions, if you don't mind. This comes from Travis. He says, number one, there's no evidence that they slashed their way out of a tent. The three cuts said to be made from the inside were not large enough for a human to escape through. If you're told to come out of a tent by threat or of harm at gunpoint, you wouldn't come out slashing out the side of the tent with knives. The hikers also didn't take any knives out of the tent. Number two, one of the two hikers found next to the cedar bit off a chunk of his hand, and it was found inside his mouth, stuck between his front teeth. And number three, the search students that found the tent hacked into it with an ice axe, removing items. And the next day it was chopped out of the ice. It was frozen to with shovels, then drug hundreds of meters over rocks and ice to the Hopad. So I don't know if he's saying that may have been what caused some of these images or, you know, some of the damage.
Yeah, I will address all of this. First of all, I don't believe they cut their way out of the tent. I think somebody else went in the tent and did this damage with what for the reason for them not to be able to go back and use the tent. Or just to kill time or to see how they were walking down. I don't believe, according to my version, they just went out to see something in the sky. I didn't say they cut their way out of the tent. I don't believe any mountaineer would do that. There is no way. That takes time. These cuts are so not efficient. Any other possibility to get out of the tent? I don't believe. I completely agree with Travis that they did not cut their tent. The cuts were made from inside, but I don't believe they did. There is something weird going with the knives too. There were no knives found with them. Absolutely very important fact. Thanks, Travis. This is one of the facts that you can actually base the case that somebody killed them or helped them or was with them and left the scene, because the branches of the trees were cut with a knife. There was no knife found around them, so somebody took it. And there was a sheet of knife and a spoon, which obviously is not used to cut branches, which later on, in the conclusion to close the case, was mentioned as Krivonischenko's knife that was found on the scene, which is a complete failure of the investigation. So just for the reason to be able to close the case, they account a knife among the items without being there. This is so wrong. I mean, so sloppy that Ivanov was so inept to do this investigation. So I completely agree with Travis on that. And what was the third one that he mentioned?
I apologize, and my email is frozen up on me here, so I'm having a hard time getting back into it.
But he's completely right, and thanks for bringing that up. I don't think they cut their way out of the tent. I don't believe that. I think somebody else destroyed the tent for them. And yes, the searchers...
The third point was, I think, about the fact that the searchers used the ice axe and shovels and then dragged it, which may have caused a lot of the damage.
They contaminated this crime scene to a level that you can't trust anything, because they even ate and some of the food. They drank some of the alcohol. They misplaced everything. They didn't protocol how many footprints were there. They could be footprints of shoes without them making the pictures. It wasn't treated as a crime scene. You can imagine their colleagues and friends are rushing to find them, to rescue them. Nobody's putting any the tapes, crime scene, and protocoling. It's not happening like on CSI. This is a complete contamination. nothing could be trusted from before the investigator or prosecutor came and started protocoling the items, which means that nothing about the tent we can trust. The only thing that I mentioned are the photos of the footprints, because I believe that nobody can leave them like that. No other creatures can leave bare footprints to stick like that, like pillars from the snow. So they did go down barefoot. Nobody removed their shoes after the fact and brought it. The shoes were found inside the tent in a pile. It's a mystery. It's a very mysterious case. You can go into details, and the more you know, the more strange it becomes. For example, on the top of the tent, they found a flashlight, which was on top of some snow. So that flash was left after the tent gathered some snow on top, and after that, the flashlight was put on top. How would that happen?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's part of this whole elegant
mystery.
Story. Yeah,
that's
and
why
it,
we're
it's an interesting
about
mystery.
This
yeah,
today.
It is.
Still 60 years it's going to be in on February 2nd.
Theodore,
or second.
Thank you so much for coming on this evening and sharing some of these insights and story. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we'll have links up and information about you as well. So thank you for being here and doing this. We appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've got it. All right. When we come back, coma, we're going to be in that space between death and life. What is it like? Paul Evans has a very unique perspective. He'll be here to share that with us right here on the best in anomalous talk radio. This is Midnight in the Desert. Welcome back to the show. We're now into our third hour, our final episode for this week. We will be back next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, brand new episodes. We will take some family time on Thursday and Friday and be playing some classic episodes of Midnight in the Desert, so please check those out. And remember that the fun continues this weekend. You can continue to hear the strange and unusual. Tim Dennis and I go beyond the darkness Saturdays and Sundays. We've got Supernatural News, Parashare tomorrow, and on Sunday, we'll be talking for the last time on our show about the JFK assassination. We have a guest that's coming forward that has had a unique opportunity to see and hold evidence that's never before been released. So we're going to talk with him about that on Sunday's episode. You can find all that information and ways to keep up with me at darknessradio.com. For the final hour, this is a topic that really grasps my attention. There's one of my favorite movies. If you haven't seen it, as you guys know, I'm an entertainment nut. There was a movie in the 80s called Creator, starring Peter O'Toole. And it's this beautiful story, and it's a very interesting, deep, dynamic story wrapped in a sci-fi movie. And at one point, one of the main characters is in a coma state, and there's the choice of what do we do to prolong this person's life? At what point is life no longer there? When has that candle gone out? So the concept of coma, what is coma? Is this, it's not exactly life, it's not exactly death, it's its own existence. And that whole dissertation that Peter O'Toole gives really kind of intrigued me to go further and read more about the people in coma patients and the experiences that they'd been through and the senses that they've had during that time, things that they were able to do, see, experience. And it just, like I said, was something that really fascinated me. Our guest this evening is Paul Evans, and he is a dad, an avid diver and shark lover, author, and co-founder and CEO of the Solutions Leisure Group, Dubai's hottest independent hospitality company. He's traveled all over the world to speak about his experiences, hoping to motivate people to be successful. Paul is currently living in Dubai, up very early this morning with us. Thank you for joining us tonight to talk about coma, that space between life and death, and tell us about your life, Paul. I appreciate this.
My pleasure, David. My pleasure.
Talk to me about your life and what it was like. I know you've got an interesting youth and a different kind of story and perspective. So let's start at that. You dealt with dyslexia growing up. Is that right?
Yeah, I was. I had quite a troubled childhood in schools. I had a wonderfully loving family, but I didn't do particularly well in schools because of I had quite severe dyslexia. So until I was sort of around 14 years of age, it wasn't diagnosed. I was considered to be quite stupid or incredibly stupid and placed in all of the bottom sets, which was extremely frustrating. And not a particularly pleasant experience. I was also quite heavily bullied because I went to a school that was not necessarily in the town where I lived as well. So up until being sort of 14 years of age, schooling was quite challenging because of the dyslexia that I had. But then when I was tested at around 14 and proved to have a reasonably higher IQ than initially considered, and then life started to turn around as I was placed in higher sets and people considered me to be slightly more educated than I actually was.
You know, kind of off topic and following in this aspect of your life, I'm fascinated. Paul, can you talk to me about having that diagnosis kind of over your head at first, or not diagnosis, but having people kind of judge you on misinterpreting your intelligence level? You had to know you weren't stupid, you weren't retarded, you weren't any of these terms that probably were slung around in your youth. What is it like to have this concept laid on you, even though your understanding of it and understanding of what life is something completely different?
Well, I don't know if I didn't think I was stupid, if I'm honest. I think that being sort of told that every other day and being asked to stand in front of the rest of the class and spell things, and, you know, you've got 28, 30 other students spelling it out for you, and in my head it just, I couldn't see the word in any way, shape or form. So I think after experiencing that for as long as I did, I'd probably convince myself as much as anybody else that maybe I wasn't particularly smart, or I never perceived myself to be smart. I perceived myself to be stupid. I knew that I had a slightly different skill set to anybody else in my class. I just hadn't really figured out at the time what it particularly was. So, yeah, it's not a case of me thinking, well, actually, I'm really smart and you guys have got it wrong. It was more of a case of maybe I'm not particularly smart. I dealt with what I had to deal with. I think the more challenging thing for me was the fact that it was quite a new thing. Dyslexia was not particularly well known when I was in school in the early, in the mid-80s. I think I was the first child in the district of where I was from to actually be clinically diagnosed as being dyslexic and then offered help from the different associations around the school. So I think I was the first child to be given the opportunity to do my GCSEs back then on a typewriter, which, you know, you'd think that would most certainly help because my handwriting was particularly scruffy, but it didn't actually. All that did was just put a bigger label on my back that I was even more different than anybody else. So I got rid of that typewriter as quick as possible, really, because that was just another focus for the bullies to concentrate on. But then
if I can mention real quickly, the part of the reason I asked that question is growing up, I was often singled out by teachers for having what they believed was a learning disability. And it was sheer boredom is what it really came down to. Not that I'm touting myself as a genius or highly intelligent, but I just wasn't motivated at the time. I thought I was buying into the concept that I was educationally stifled, that I maybe wasn't as smart as everybody else and I wasn't able to do this. And to me, it was a very weird label because, again, I felt like I was moving underneath the mask of a perception that I couldn't see and couldn't understand, but it was the way I was treated. And it wasn't until an independent counselor in my school took my mom aside and said, I think they've got this wrong. I'm willing to bet if we test this kid, he's got a lot more going on than everybody's giving him credit for. And I was testing through the roof on what I was able to do. I grew bored and weary with the way they taught in school. So I had no focus for what they were doing. But in a short burst, you could teach me something. I remembered it. I knew what was going on. You know, as an aside, when I left high school, I decided 3 years later to enter college and didn't pick up a book and took my ACT and passed my ACT to get into college and some of the other acceptance tests to get through. And, you know, counselors were asking, how did you get here? What did you do? You know, And it was still that concept of understanding and learning, but being perceived a different way. So I was interested in what your story was. I didn't deal with dyslexia, but I did deal with having a stigma kind of attached to me for a while and realizing that, you know, I for a while let it limit me. Did it, and it sounds like you kind of did it as well. You didn't know that you weren't stupid. You kind of bought in on the concept until things started to come into set of understanding what it was you were dealing with. And it wasn't stupidity or ignorance. It was just a different way of learning and a different way of perceiving things.
Yeah, and mainly focusing my attentions on what, where dyslexia takes something away. Obviously, spelling and handwriting are particularly challenging for me, and even today I scribble like a spider, and my spelling is farcical. But it doesn't matter, because what dyslexia does bring me is another set of skills that I've honed on and I've focused on, and I've used those to help me grow in the career in that I wanted to grow into. So I was never ever going to be an author. I might write a reasonable book, and I might tell a great story, but to try and put it down on paper myself is something I physically can't do. So instead of really focusing on that, I used what dyslexia does bring me, which is a different way to look at things, problem solving, etc., etc., and focused on that. But until I realized what it was, and even then, you know, back when I was sort of 13 or 14, it took me a while to realize that this wasn't particularly important, and my career and my growth didn't really begin until sort of the later years of school, and when I got the opportunity to begin sort of starting my own little businesses or moving into the corporate world when I left school and college and went into the banking industry, that I really started to be able to experience what skills I had as opposed to focusing on the skills that I didn't. But you know, as a school kid, everyone likes to stick a label on somebody, and obviously for a long period of my life that label was stupid, and until I was diagnosed, I believed it was exactly the same as everybody was calling me, and everyone was labeling me as. So yeah, you know, you look back now and you think it was particularly challenging. It was actually the making of me. If I'd not been through those challenges as a youngster, I'm not sure I'd be able to sort of overcome adversity like I do now. Right. I think it's all a foundation. It all helps to build the backbone of whatever you become in your life.
You dealt with some adversity, as we just said, growing up. And
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. At what age did you have your near-death experience?
I went to sleep when I was 29, and I woke up on. Sorry, I went to sleep when I was 28, and I woke up on my 29th birthday.
All right. What happened to you?
15 years ago. Wow. Okay. So I was. I had left the banking industry. So I worked for a very large American bank out of Manchester in the UK. I decided I needed a bit of time off. I'd done, you know, financially quite well up until that point in my life. I'd had quite an accelerated career path, but I needed some time out. I needed to take a bit of a break. My father was building a diving safari boat in the Red Sea resort of Hurghada in Egypt, and I decided to go and be a diving instructor for a year and just relax a little bit. Probably 3 months into that process, I went out one night, had far too much to drink with a couple of Dutch guys who owned a bar, and probably around 6 a.m. in the morning, I agreed to lend them some money. I have no memory of this whatsoever, even to today. Woke up the next day to a text message asking when they could pick the money up. And at that point, I became a shareholder, a small shareholder in a bar. I got carried away with that. I spent sort of a year enjoying the high life of being a bar and nightclub owner. And then sort of around late July, I woke up one morning, was in excruciating pain. My stomach was the size of an 8-month pregnant lady. I was enormous. You could see the veins in the side of my stomach. I was taken to hospital. Within 24 hours, my lungs had collapsed. I was given a lung puncture, which I was unfortunately awake for as they did that. But as they sort of banged that spike through my ribs, the lady, the nurse, realised I was awake, popped a needle into my leg, and that was the last memory I had of being in Egypt. And I then was air ambulanced back to England, where I was put into intensive care and spent 77 days in another world, living a life in Singapore in a coma. And then I woke up, was operated on, and then spent another 3 or 4 months in hospital recovering from what was acute pancreatitis.
Right. So what was it that originally threw you into the hospital?
I had acute pancreatitis.
All right. And that things had gone horribly wrong in that, and that's what put you into this coma? Or was it a medically induced coma?
It was a medically induced coma. So obviously what happens with acute pancreatitis is that your pancreas begins to secrete the enzymes that digest your food. They disappear off into your body and start digesting your internal organs. And to slow that process down while the doctors look after you and repair you and take care of you, they put you into a coma. So that all of your organs slow down. I was obviously fed through pipes. I was being kept alive, breathing through a tracheotomy. Then the doctors have time to do their jobs, and eventually, what would be probably 3 months later, then I had an operation and they removed 85% of my pancreas.
When you were in this induced coma, talk to me about this experience and what that was like. Do you have conscious memory of time passing, or was this like an overnight dream?
No. This was not like a dream. This was a complete, full, technicolored, alternate life. 15 years ago it happened, and I can remember today. Like it was a memory of when you were at school or when you were at college. It was not like when people wake up and they have those very realistic dreams and it takes them a couple of minutes to come round and they're a bit confused about what happened. I never had that. I had absolute clarity on where I lived, what car I drove, what my job was, what I wore to go to work, what my house looked like, what my kitchen looked like, the colleagues, the people that I worked with, the journey to work in the morning. I lived a complete other life. The time ratio was different. So while I was asleep, I had a full a year where I was away. That was the timelines in my world, where the actual reality it was more like 3 months. But no, it was a complete other life. I got up in the morning, I would get dressed, I'd have my breakfast, I would jump in my car, I drove a black Jaguar, I would drive the road to work in Singapore, over the bridges into a business centre, park the car, walk into the office, like everybody does on a normal day. It was exactly the same as if I was living that actual life.
That is so depressing, David. Paul. I want to fly amongst the stars. I want to visit foreign lands. I don't want to know that in my coma state, in an alternate reality, I'm still working. That is not good. Good night. We're done. Let's all go to bed.
I actually think that it was a way of my brain keeping me occupied and keeping me intrigued into keeping me busy to give the doctors the time that they required. To get me better. I mean, the job that I was doing, we were building and creating and then eventually selling virtual reality lifestyles. So the software would be that you could buy anybody's life. So if I wanted to buy your life, I could go and buy your life. I would wake up in the morning, I would be a famous radio show host, and I would live your life. If I wanted to be Muhammad Ali, I would buy that experience, and I would dance like a butterfly and sting like a bee.
I've got a deal for you. $22.95, and my life is yours right now. You can buy in if you'd like. Very rock bottom prices.
The day the check's in the post.
All right. Well, that's pretty exciting. I mean, that's an interesting aspect of this. Now, when you would see yourself in this alternate timeline, did you look like you, or were you living the life of someone else?
No, I was me. That was me. My father was in my dream. My grandfather was in my dream. Unfortunately, during that dream, my father passed away. I had quite a surreal experience that was very, very interesting. And I'm still, 15 years on, trying to comprehend exactly what that meant. But
sorry, you sound like you got a little far away from your phone all of a sudden.
Sorry, I was saying that I had an experience where my grandfather came to me in my dream on a beach in on Singapore, And we would throw a ball to each other, and he would talk to me. And he took this moment to tell me that my father was very proud of me, and that I should never worry and dedicate only my life to trying to make my parents and my father in particular proud. He would always be proud of me, but unfortunately he had terminal cancer, and he was going to leave me. And then my grandfather disappeared. I would then that evening went and had dinner in the back streets of Singapore, having some street food. My dad came to me, wished me all my best in my life, gave me the biggest hug in the world, told me he would be eternally proud of me, and then left. And then that was my father dying in my dream. And then when I woke up, it took probably 3 to 4 days for my family to convince me that the man at the end of the bed was still my dad, and that nothing had actually happened, and it was a dream, and that I was in England, I wasn't in Singapore. And so that was a very unusual experience. Looking back now, one of the evenings, there was a number of incidences during my coma where I got particularly sick. One of them was where I got a blockage in one of my arteries, and my temperature went through the roof, and the nurses and doctors were very concerned that I wouldn't actually make it through this incident, and they called the priest into the room to give me the last rites. My father categorically refused that I was going anywhere, and asked the priest very politely to leave. And I believe, looking back now, that was not actually my dad saying goodbye to me in my dream. That was me saying goodbye to my father, and as I've had such a close relationship with that man, that was some way of, in the alternate world of me dealing with being particularly sick and saying goodbye to my dad. But I didn't, and I obviously the doctors did what they had to do, and that evening my temperature dropped and I continued to recover.
Wow, what a remarkable story. When you're living this life, are you kind of aware that you're straddling two lifetimes? When you're there, do you wake up and you're like, well, this isn't what I remember, but I'll go about it on a normal basis? And I mean, are you dating? Are you eating? Are you bathing? Is it like you are living a regular everyday lifestyle there?
All of the above and more. So yes, I didn't believe that I was living an alternate life. I didn't believe that this is not my normal life. It was as absolute technical as anybody's normal daily work. So yes, I did all of it. I didn't have a girlfriend, but I did go out for dinner. I would meet with friends in the evening. I would come home late in the evening and get into bed and do all the things that normal people do. Yeah, it was not. There was no moment during that coma where I believed that this was something else. It was my life. That's what I was doing. So, how I came out of that experience was that we were testing the latest version of our software, and I was, as I headed up the sales team, I was due to be the person that was tasked to test this software and make sure it was okay. So as I climbed into the machine and the programmers began to do their job, as I was about to enter into the virtual world, the machinery broke and the software crashed. And then that left me blocked in this sort of middle ground between real world Singapore and alternate world of virtual reality, and it left me in a box, in a black, completely black box, with no sides, with no lights, with no way of knowing where I was. But I could hear them. I could hear the computer programmers talking to me. I could tell that they were telling me, "Don't worry, Paul. Everything's going to be okay. We can see you. We can. We're just going to try and fix, put a patch over this piece of software to pull you back out." And this process went on for about 3 months. During that 3 months, the messages they were giving me became less and less about what they were doing to try and fix the problem, and more general about what was happening in the news. They would play music to me, they would read the sports results to me, and I started to realize that actually they were not going to get me out of this situation, and if I didn't do something, I would remain there. So then I began furiously picking away anywhere within this black box to try and find some way of opening the box, of trying to find my way out.
Wait, but you're aware that time is passing. You're aware that this is a 3-month span. So you're aware of a 24-hour day cycle. How are you not losing your mind? Are you hearing communication? Are they telepathically speaking to you? Is it like an intercom system?
No, it's like I'm talking to you now. So I can hear you down the phone and you can hear me down the phone. I could hear them talking to me. What it actually was, it was my parents and my family talking to me. They would come to the room every morning. They would see me lying
in bed. So it was your parents in this reality talking to you.
Yes.
And you're inside the box, the life between lives, and you're hearing this. I've got one question for you. And, you know, as we're leading into the last 2 minutes here, Paul, how do you know this is the real world? How do you know that you and I having this conversation isn't the coma world and that back in Singapore you're really sick and laying in bed somewhere?
I hope not, because I've had far too much fun in the last 15 years to wake up tomorrow and find out that it's not real. No,
this sounds like the movie Total Recall, right? I mean, in the sense that you're doing a VR kind of world and all of a sudden kind of wake up within the VR world and realize that you're not part of either one.
Without a doubt, this experience and what went through me was different memories, different movies, different things that I'd experienced. My father took me to Singapore when I was 12 years of age. I've never been prior to that. Obviously, I'd watched the film The Matrix. That was a big part of the thought process that must have been going on in my mind. So eventually, 3 months in, I decided I needed to come out of this. There was only me that was going to get me out of this situation. And I spent 3 months picking away at this box till eventually I managed to get my little finger through. Now, I'm a nail biter, so I have no nails. And I remember getting extremely frustrated that I didn't have nails. Which the funny thing is, when I woke up from the coma, I had full nails and a full head of hair. But I was continued to pick, managed to get a finger through. Then I got a second finger through. I got a hand through. I pulled my arm through. Eventually pulled my head through, pulled the rest of my body through, and I woke up. I actually woke up, and my parents and my family and my friends were at the end of my bed, and it was my 29th birthday, and I was out of that.
So you were legitimately born again. You were metaphorically and physically rebirthing yourself on your birthday. Paul Evans, Coma, The Space Between Life and Death. We will come back and continue to examine this story. We've got links up to Paul's site, whenIwokeUp.ae. You can find that at midnightinthedesert.com. Fascinating story. The next half an hour is going to fly by. We're going to try to cram in as much information as we possibly can. And remember, you can find information about this guest and all of our guests by visiting midnightinthedesert.com. November 30th, December 1st, and 2nd, I will be in Madison, Wisconsin at Wizard World Comic Book Convention. I will be leading paranormal talks each day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and leading some celebrity panels with Dean Cain, Superman, cast members from the TV show Supernatural, Matt Ryan from Constantine. I'd love for you guys to come on out, check out, and get tickets and information at wizardworld.com. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of the best in anomalous talk radio. This is Midnight in the Desert. We're wrapping up another edition of the best in anomalous talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. This is Midnight in the Desert, and I want to address our listeners very quickly, all of you that have hit me up through social media and emails, private messages, for your support. As I mentioned, I had lost my mom 2 years ago on the 15th, and when I had posted up a little tribute to her, I was very touched with the way many of you reached out to me, so thank you very much. I don't want you to think that went unappreciated. It meant quite a bit to me and my family to see the nice comments and emails that you guys sent to me, so thank you so much for doing that. We're back and talking with our guest, a fascinating story, Coma, The Space Between Life and Death. Paul Evans sharing probably one of the most unique stories I've ever heard, and I can tell you in 13 years and speaking to probably about 100, 150 coma patients, I've never heard an experience remotely like this. I've heard the experience where they have been off-world. They have been roaming this planet in an astral form and visiting and checking in on others, but I've never heard the idea that they lived another life existing. Now, do you believe that that actually might be taking place, that you were checking in on a consciousness of an alternate reality version of yourself? Do you think there might be that possibility that was going on, or was it your brain's way, as you mentioned, of shielding you and keeping you active until you were ready to come back?
I think it was the second one. I think it was my mind and my soul and my body taking me off and keeping me busy and keeping me occupied. I've always been somebody that keeps busy as much as I can. I like to try and fit as much into my days as possible, fit as much into my life as possible. And I think this was my way of my mind protecting me from what was going on, how sick I really was. You know, I had a multitude of different conditions as well. It wasn't just acute bronchiolitis. I had E. coli as well. I had MRSA. I had a collapsed lung. So I was a poorly, poorly boy. My mind was busy to make sure and protect me from all of that that was going on outside of me, and to give the doctors enough time to make me better and to bring me back and to give me that second chance that I am now doing my absolute utmost to maximize.
Unbelievable story. Okay, so now you peel your way back out of this box. You rebirth yourself and awaken on your birthday. And you have a room full of people.
Nobody wants to miss a birthday, Dave, do they?
No. God, not me. Mine's coming up on Thursday. I want to make sure I'm here for that as well. So you come out of this. How much of this immediately do you remember? Is this like one deep memory, just like it had happened in regular waking life for you as well? Or did this take a while to kind of recoup and find this story again?
No, I couldn't talk when I came out of the coma. So if you take a sort of a timeline, I woke up on the 31st of August. I spent a few hours with my family for my birthday. I couldn't talk to anybody. Obviously, I had a tracheotomy in. I was clearly quite weak still, but I was awake, and that's the first memory I had of not being in Singapore, not being in the virtual reality world of the software, but actually being in a hospital bed. But then I went back to sleep again for a couple of days. I think it was about 4 days before they I woke again, just prior to me having the operation. So, no, it was not a case of I had to sort of drag that memory up and tell people. I couldn't really write. There are some notes of things that I wrote as soon as I came out of the coma, where I'd noted that my father had died and that I'd lived in Singapore and things like that. But sort of post-operation, which would be 9 days later, which is when I completely woke up and I was back to having a normal life, which was on the 9th of September, I was then able to, I think, quite quickly start to recover to the point where they could then take away certain drainage and the life support machine, and then I was quite quickly able to start talking and then explain what I believed had happened, and then actually listen to my parents and doctors explain to me what had really happened. And as I say, there was a little bit of a battle in my conscious thought process of, no, why are you telling me this? Why do I have this big scar across, or this big cut across my stomach? Why have I got all these cables in me? Why are all the, you know, why is my father still here? It did take some time for that to actually become reality for me, and for me to realize that what had happened to me and where I'd been and the last 3 months of my life was actually not real. It was a dream in an induced coma, and that the real reality was that I was very, very poorly. I was in a hospital bed in Crewe in England, and that nobody died, and my family were there to look after me and make sure that they were next to me as I began the road to recovery. I mean, I lost 45 kilos. So to give you some idea, today I walk around at about 80 kilos. When they tried to jam me into that aeroplane, which they couldn't quite fit me through the door, I was so big, I was 118 kilos. So it took me a month to walk again. That's how much of my body had depleted during that 3 months.
Was there a sense of mourning the life that you had lost? I mean, the 3 month span and friendships, relatives, things like that. I mean, was there any of that sense to you, or has there been since you returned?
No, I think. I think that the biggest sense that I had was really guilt for what everybody else experienced while I was away. While I was away, I was having a great time. I wasn't experiencing any of the pain. I wasn't experiencing any of the anguish or the hurt or the fear that everybody else around that room, whoever came to see me, was experiencing. You know, even now, 15 years on, when I think about just, you know, what were my parents going through? You know, I have a five-year-old son who had some teeth out recently. It was the most horrific experience I think I've ever been through, because it was my little boy and I was next to him and I couldn't help him, and he was going through pain and he was confused and he was sad. And that's a couple of teeth. You know, my parents walked into that room every single day wishing I would wake up. So, no, I didn't really have a feeling of I missed that life. I had far more a feeling of the lifestyle that I'd led, the selfish drinking and partying environment, had brought me to a point where I was so poorly that I then put my friends and my family and my loved ones through such a traumatic experience. I think that feeling of guilt washed out any other feelings that I may have had of missing living in Singapore and doing the job I did. And it was a good job. It was a great life. But no, it's more of guilt and concern for what the other people that were around me had to experience.
I only ask that because I've had dreams where, you know, somebody dies in a dream, and even for that day I carry around that sense of loss, and I know it was a dream. So to have lived 3 months in this virtual world, I just wondered if there was an emotional impact that happened to you regarding not being a part of that lifestyle anymore. But, you know, obviously it's nice to be back here among the life that you were used to.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's not. I don't know.
As fun as the job was, you know, to lose my father in the dream and to really, really believe that was actually real. And to then realize that it wasn't was obviously an immense relief to me.
Oh, I can only imagine. To wake up, boy, I would give anything to have that happen tomorrow, to wake up and find that my mom is still alive. So I can only imagine what sense of relief and joy that must have brought your heart. Yeah.
It gave me a perspective that without that experience, and, you know, I get asked regularly, you know, would you change? Would you, you know, if you go back in time, would you make it different? Would you have drank? Would you have bought into the nightclub? Would you have lived a different life? I absolutely would not have changed anything. The only thing I would have changed in that entire experience is the pain and anguish that I caused the people around me. Without any of that, without the pain that I went through and the illness that I had, I wouldn't be the person I am today. I wouldn't be able to appreciate how I appreciate. The scariest of things to me was that I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. I didn't get a chance to put right any of the things that I'd said in the past. I didn't get a chance to tell everybody what they meant to me. Literally, I felt poorly. I had a very large stomach. I was popped into the back of a car. I was driven at breakneck speed to a hospital. And then the lights went out. And you don't realize just how serious that situation can become until it becomes. And the perspective of having that and to survive it means that I will never put myself in a position like that again, where the people around me don't know just how important they are to me and how dedicated I am to be part of their lives. So it was absolutely the best thing that could ever, ever have happened to me. And that's the weird, if you'd seen me back then and what I looked like, to say that was the best thing that could ever happen. Yeah, very very unusual, but it was absolutely the best thing that ever could happen. And I wouldn't change it for the world.
Wow, that is a beautiful perspective. So you have this major life change. Now, you did time in prison?
Twice. Unfortunately, yeah.
Twice.
Yeah, I did it once in England when I was 21 years of age, and then I was—I did 12 days in a Cairo jail. It was a horrendous experience. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dave. Yeah, I was going to say you've really lived a life and a half. So I understand where you're coming. Now, you said you wouldn't have changed anything. How about those aspects? Would you? From that?
The negativity of some of those incidents that have happened in my life, I was able to turn them into the most positive of things and refocus and realign. And, you know, certain things are needed in our world to bring us back on track and make us realize what's important. That, you know, the title of the book is When I Woke Up. And on the surface of things, that's when I woke up from a coma. It is way deeper than that, Dave. It's I woke up and realized that how I'd lived my life in the past, how I'd focused, what my targets were, the things that I'd wanted to do with my life, and they were wrong. I had it all wrong. I woke up to how to be a better person, how to actually live your life in a positive manner, how to take all of those negative experiences that, for whatever reason, somebody in life and the greater hand has given me, I got through them all and I grew and I got better. Now, what can I do with that experience? How can I help other people to learn from what I experienced? So no negative situation I've ever been through would I remove, would I erase from my memory. I learned and I grew and I developed and I became more empathetic to other individuals because I'd been through all of that stuff.
The sad part is, you know, until you've had that experience, it's hard to really give people that hiccup, that life interrupt to do that. Now, listen, we can be inspired, you know, in short ways by movies. When I saw the movie Creator, it really touched me and, again, gave me some insight. Again, the movie About Time did the same thing. Unfortunately, it's never a prolonged impact. It's something that's there for a short time and then you move back into life. What do you recommend to people to really, you know, have that perspective, to maintain that perspective and live that life? It's not painful to live a better life. Why do we keep reverting back, do you think?
I think that, and it's interesting that you asked that question, actually. It's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and it's something I'm very busy with on a daily basis. Probably the most appreciative I think I've ever been in my 44 years of being on this planet was probably the 12 months after I woke up. So the 12 months of the coma, when I was still recovering, you know, I was still 3 months in hospital. That was then another at least 6 months getting better to the point where I was something of my own, my previous self, confidence levels-wise or activity-wise. But every single morning I would wake up and I would hear the birds tweeting and I would see the sun in the sky and I would believe that I had a second chance. And you're right, that inspirational moment of, wow, here I go again, we do. We allow dilution. We allow to forget just how blessed we really are to be given the opportunities that we're given. So I still try every single day of my life to refocus in the morning on just whatever it is I have. I have got air in my lungs, and when you've had an experience like I had, I nearly didn't. So every single thing else is an absolute bonus. And just to take the time to reflect on that, at any point in the day, and we're all faced with challenges, we all have difficult things. It doesn't, you know, success is just a gauge of wherever we put our perimeters. But we're all faced with different challenges every single day, and I continually remember how bad it could have been. So anything past that is an incredible place to be.
Has time changed for you? And that's beautiful advice. Has time and the way you perceive time changed for you now?
Time is one of the biggest factors in my life. I have a tattoo on my chest, which is a clock, and I had it put there because of how important time is. Dave, time changes absolutely everything. We can worry about things, won't change it. We can stress about things, it won't change it. But time automatically changes absolutely every situation we're faced with. It's the most important factor any one of us have in our lives. And when you learn to embrace it, understand it, and work with it, it can be an incredible, powerful thing. So, yeah, time is huge for me. Huge.
Have you found that you've found an effective way to slow down time? I know that's something that's been a big concept for me to understand it. Well, I ask that because people that have had near-death experiences do seem to have figured that angle out a little bit better, and I didn't know if that's something that's been gifted to you as well.
I don't think I've figured out a way to slow it down, but I am working on that. I think I've found a way to maximize it, to use as much of it as you can, to fit as much experience and as possible into your working days and your social time. I've figured out a way, or I'm now busy to make sure that I use as much of it as possible for the different elements of my life that I believe to be important as well. So as opposed to just work, you know, I have a family, I have a young family, I have two amazing young boys. To find enough time to fit everything in is the challenge that I have, but that's the thing that I'm working on most of all. So unfortunately I can't slow it down just yet, but I can make sure I fit as much of it, much of my life into it as possible.
Have you had other out-of-body experiences since that near-death moment?
No, not post my hospital experience. I did, while they once they operated on me, I had a very surreal experience where I was in the corner of the operating theatre and watched the surgeons work on me. I watched how calm it was. It wasn't a particularly scary experience. It was quite a surreal experience. Very calm. But at one point during the operation, my heart stopped, and I watched them restart me. That was an incredible enhancement and reiteration of what had happened to me. But post recovery from that, from the hospital, no, I've never had another situation like that. I have moments where those memories come back to me in a strong way. For whatever reason, I'll be doing something and the memories of what happened to me in my life in Singapore come flooding back and remind me again of what's going on. And especially at the moment while we're writing this book, those memories are more at the forefront of my mind than they have been for quite a while. But not another actual out-of-body experience, no.
Do you ever ask why was I gifted this opportunity to come back when others haven't? And what do you think is the answer?
That's been probably the biggest question I think I've had from the whole situation. You know, why me? Why did somebody believe that I should be given a second chance? And I think one of the first things that comes to my thought process is that prior to being sick and being poorly, I'd never really wanted children. It was not something that was on my agenda in the foreseeable future. But within 9 months of coming out of hospital, my girlfriend was pregnant with my first son, Cole. So I believe that a lot of the opportunity and the second chance I've been given will be administered through my two children. I think that there's some real justification to the great work that I'm trying to do now, how I try to use my experiences to help people and grow other individuals that are around me, whether it's socially or within the company that we own and we operate. Those experiences that I can pass on are some reason for why I went through what I went through. So most certainly there's multitude of reasons why I was given a second chance. And to do the right thing, to be a better man than I was yesterday.
All right. Well, now that's a big concept, to be gifted that and to come back and be a better man. Tell me, if you could give me two things that weren't family related, not the yada yada love my family stuff, but what two things have you done? Well, I mean, that's something we all kind of understand, but I mean, what with this gift, what have you done to come back and make the world a better place?
Okay, so I think the thought process of when I woke up and to become and to be better than I was yesterday, prior to being poorly, I'd become very self-centered. I'd gone from being an underconfident, bullied, dyslexic schoolboy to being, if anything, overconfident, arrogant, and carried away with my own life and lost focus on those around me. I think coming out of the coma and what I've tried to do post-coma and over the last sort of 10 years is to help other people around me, to have more concern about how I can help and develop and grow other people, whatever that may be, than just my life. What am I doing? Where am I going? And how am I going to get there quicker? That would be the biggest thing that I took from that experience. What I tried to do every single day of the week. You know, we're a fabulous little organisation based out of Dubai. We've got, you know, close on to 450 people working for us today, and our job is to try and do our absolute utmost to make those people the best versions of themselves. And that's something that
that's a pretty respectable goal. I respect that quite a bit. Again, I know people that have come back, myself included. You know, I look at some of the facts of where I've been in my life, and now what have I done with it when I've come back? I've faced some points where I probably shouldn't still be here. And, you know, on a daily basis, I do kind of challenge myself to, what are we going to do next? What can we do, you know, to try to make a difference? And I do it in little ways. But I'm just curious, in some cases, I talk to people that have had a chance and they're still just kind of squandering life. And it's...
I think, you know, the reason for this book, David, is not it's not so I can sell however many thousand copies and make however
right.
much money you make from that. The majority of the book revenue will be given to my mother for her to decide what she wants to do from a charity perspective. My mum does a lot of great work with charity, and I've watched how that's given her a real purpose. Selfless acts is a fabulous thing, and my mum is an inspiration in that. The book's not written for any financial gain for myself. The book is written because I hope that a 13-year-old child who's got a bottle of pills and a bottle of whiskey in his hand and was sitting exactly how I was sitting at 13 years of age can read it and realize that what may be true today does not necessarily have to be true tomorrow. The business challenges, you know, I lost my entire business in Egypt. We had a very, very successful business. I got on an aeroplane, I came to Dubai, I had a shower, and I got over it, and I went again. And anybody that has been through anything like me, whether it is a troubled childhood, a serious illness, a loss of a business that they've worked incredibly hard for, anybody that can read my book and take inspiration to go again, get up, have a shower, get ready, and go again. That for me is, you know, answers that question of why was I given a second chance? Because hopefully I can help somebody else to have a second chance. Hopefully somebody will read it and think, you know what? If he can do it, I can do it. And why not? So as as I've tried to do it with the company that I've built today, now what I want to try and do with when I woke up or any other opportunities that come from that is to help and motivate people that I've not yet met to get up tomorrow and go again.
Do you carry forward any fear of death?
Yeah, I do.
Is that surprising, knowing what you've been through?
Yes and no. I think I'm petrified, and I was always what came from it. And I mentioned this before: the lights go out, and you don't get a chance to say goodbye. That fear will remain with me forever. The actual fear of death does not necessarily frighten me. It's the fear of loss. What will I lose? What will the people around me lose? What did I miss out on doing before I die is my fear. That the lights just go out. That was the scary thing for me, that I wasn't part of being able to say goodbye. So yes, I fear death for the anguish and the distress and the pain that it causes everybody else. Not for myself, but, you know, as I said before, the coma was not painful for me. The illness was only painful when I woke up and I had to begin the recovery. But the process that I had to go through was incredibly painful for all of those people around me. And I would guess that my death would be something similar. So that's the bit I fear more than anything, not what I have to experience, but
right.
what my loved
what
ones
you leave behind. The true story of Paul Evans, when I woke up, we've got a link to that on the site. We are out of time. Paul, thank you so much for spending time with us this evening.
Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure.
Teodora, the Dyatlov Pass incident, evidence revealed. Great shows this week. A lot of fun. Thank you all for tuning in and being a part of the world. Remember to check me out this weekend on Beyond the Darkness, Saturday and Sunday. You can get info at darknessradio.com and check midnightinthedesert.com this weekend for brand new supernatural shorts, videos from Nick Groff and Elizabeth Saint. That's it for this week. Be kind, love one another, and enjoy your lives. We'll see you again right here on the best in anomalous talk radio on Monday night. This is Midnight in the Desert. Honey, I'm coming home.
Midnight in the desert, and we're listening. Ooh, we're listening.